From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, it has been more than 100 years, and still the theories abound of who was Jack the Ripper. Well, we're going to go live to the United Kingdom. Guest Trevor Marriott, author of Jack the Ripper, The 21st Century Investigation, will offer some of his thoughts. Well, this is truly an unbelievable story. Authorities are investigating the disappearance from a New Jersey bioterror research lab of at least three mice carrying a deadly strain of plague. Sources say FBI agents and bioterrorism experts have interviewed and polygraphed employees at the University of Medicine and Dentistry in Newark, New Jersey, the location of the lab run by the Public Health Research Institute, which is a leading center for research on infectious diseases. The mice have been missing for approximately 2 weeks. The FBI responded to the matter, and well, a dedicated number of agents are beginning to question people. They're satisfied that there is no public safety risk. They say there doesn't seem to be any nexus to criminal activity or terrorism. Officials discovered 2 weeks ago a failure to account for three of the 24 mice that had been injected with a bacterium that causes various forms of the plague, including bubonic plague, inside the high security facility located in the middle of the city of Newark. The injections were part of an experiment testing potential treatments of that plague. Well, now Tropical Storm Ophelia. She was a storm, a hurricane. Now she's a storm again. Stalled Thursday just off North Carolina's Outer Banks, prolonging the wind and rain, blasting the fragile barrier islands, even as it appeared the mainland had avoided severe flooding. Thousands of homes and businesses had no electricity. As the erratic storm slowed almost to a halt during the early afternoon, the National Hurricane Center said its northern eye wall, the ring of high wind surrounding the eye, could remain over the Outer Banks for another 12 hours or so. President Bush offered the nation's condolences to victims of Hurricane Katrina, thanking all the emergency workers and promising support in cleaning up and rebuilding after that disaster. Tonight, he says, I also offer this pledge to the American people. Throughout the area hit by the hurricane, we will do what it takes. We will stay as long as it takes to help citizens rebuild their communities and their lives. It was a primetime address to the nation that lasted 23 minutes. All those who question the future, he says, of the Crescent City need to know that there is no way to imagine America without New Orleans, and this great city will rise again. As a matter of fact, New Orleans will begin to reopen to businesses this weekend, and the first residents will be allowed to return to their homes on Monday, according to the mayor there. The city of New Orleans started this weekend, and they'll start to breathe again. It will have life. It will have commerce, according to the mayor of New Orleans. And they're going to start, of course, too, in the French Quarter. Get that going. The floodwaters continue to recede on the city's hard-hit east side. Records, by the way, for the past 35 years show that hurricanes have gotten stronger in recent times. This fits with the mounting evidence, which is suggesting the biggest storms around the world, hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones, are intensifying. They think it's the greenhouse warming effect. I think it's a cycle, quite frankly. You know, one of the parents under investigation for having some of their 11 adopted children sleep in cages there in Ohio, this story, defended their actions, saying the homemade enclosures were meant to protect youngsters who set fires and injured each other. Michael and Sharon Gravel of Wakeman, Ohio, have denied abusing or neglecting the children, who are ages 1 to 14. They have conditions that include autism and fetal alcohol syndrome. No charges have been filed, and the children, whose situation was discovered last week, are now in foster care. Up on the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the story of Mitsubishi banking on robotic companions. They have built a robot. They're selling. This critter is yellow-faced, silver arms. It's a she, at least voice-wise, able to recognize up to 10 people, call them by name. The thing's 40 inches tall. It will approach and greet family members in a very gentle, feminine voice when they arrive home. It will pass on telephone messages. It will read out any emails in the morning. It will glide to your bedside to wake you up with news headlines and the weather forecast. And if security at home is a worry, well, it will call you on your mobile phone when you're out and check the situation through a camera mounted on its forehead. It doesn't come cheap. It's $14,000. And then there's a monthly maintenance charge of about $90 a month. Well, sign of the times, isn't it? A $300 million civil case, by the way, brought by a Russian astrologer against NASA for what she says, ruining her predictions by crashing a probe into a comet. And that suit is now underway in Moscow. Marina Bai claims that NASA interfered with her predictions by denting its deep impact space probe into Temple 1 comet in July. She's now demanding $300 million in compensation from NASA for ruining her career. I don't think she'd ever make $300 million as an astrologer. The astrologer said at the time of the experiment, it is obvious that elements of the comet's orbit and correspondingly the parts of it will be distorted, and I won't be able to do what I do. The NASA probe, as you know, smashed July 4th, sent the probe into the comet Temple with some remarkable pictures. Now, in a moment, John Rappaport, our guest, investigative reporter, we're going to talk about this strange plague, these mice that escaped or disappeared. Who knows what happened to them? We're going to talk with John Rappaport about it in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, for more than 20 years, John Rappaport has worked as an investigative reporter. He is the author of 5 books. He has written on medical fraud, deep politics, health issues for newspapers, magazines in the U.S. and Europe, including CBS, Health Watch, Spin, Stern, and LA Weekly. The LA Weekly placed John's name in nomination for a Pulitzer Prize for his interview with the president of Salvador University, where a military takeover had occurred. When I saw this story on the infected mice disappearing from the lab up there in Newark, New Jersey, I thought, we've got to get John on. John, what a strange story. Have you had a chance to look into it deeply now?
Yeah, I have, George. Thanks for the heads up. It's incredibly bizarre. Basically, as you said at the top of the show, they have no idea what happened to these 3 out of the 24 mice that they had experimentally injected with various kinds of plague. They don't know whether it was an accounting error or whether the mice were eaten by other animals or they escaped or what happened to them. So that points up, you know, the incredibly shoddy controls that they exercise at this particular lab right in the heart of a major city, Newark. And there they are. I mean, they're kind of skating and trying to, backstep and make all kinds of excuses and say that one researcher said, well, if these animals escaped, they would be dead by now. But as it turns out, of the 24 animals they injected at the lab with plague, there are several that are still alive. So <Yeah. laughs> why couldn't these be still alive?
You know, John, you are absolutely right. It may not be the fact that these mice have disappeared. What it is the controls. But I do have to ask you, if they indeed were popped with bubonic plague, for example, and they got loose, couldn't that cause a problem?
It could cause a problem in other animals or in people who have suppressed immune systems. That would be the danger. During the plague, you know, medieval Europe, basically the people who lived out in the countryside and were reasonably healthy for that period of time, there were very few fatalities. It was people in larger centers that were the most affected. So the plague is not, you know, what it's been cracked up to be by the alarmists, but yet, if you've got people, say, in nursing homes, for example, who are on all kinds of drugs already and their immune systems are tremendously suppressed, yeah, that could definitely be a problem for them as well as for other animals. So there is that. There is definitely that.
John, the injections were part of an experiment testing potential treatments for plague. There is no plague. Now they've created the plague. Why are they testing for something that we don't really have to worry about right now?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They do this all the time. In the case of plague, they tout it as a potential bioweapon, and that's how they justify their research. In other words, somebody else could be trying to develop this and spread it, so therefore we have to develop a vaccine against it, and we have to do experiments on animals, et cetera, et cetera. So that is their reasoning. But that is the exact same reasoning that has been used in the U.S. and in other countries to justify offensive research in bioweaponry. In other words, everybody says we're doing defensive, you know, bioweapon research. That's what they all say, all countries, including the U.S. And so we don't really know, you know, what the purpose of this research was. They claim it's for disease treatment and develop vaccines, but it could be experiments that really are geared at producing offensive bioweapons. That is still up in the air, and it could go either way, and we'll probably never find out because this is a classified facility.
Wasn't it about a year ago that you and I were talking on this very program about the Chiron contamination of flu vaccines? And now we have this situation. It looks like the controls in these laboratories are pretty shoddy, John.
They are. Back in 1987, when I was researching my first book, AIDS, Inc., I interviewed a number of people who worked in biowarfare labs and disease, especially animal labs. And I discovered then, much to my horror, the incredibly lax controls in these places. I mean, this is not the exception. It's more like the rule. Because when you have large numbers of animals and you're experimenting on them and you have them in cages and you know, you try to get in there and clean the cages, you try to keep good control. It is not an easy thing, and it's difficult to keep the book straight and to know who's been around and who's done what. And I remember some reports that came to me from a researcher about the University of Columbia, Columbia University in the middle of New York City, and another lab up in San Francisco area, which were both animal labs. And I mean, to read these reports, which were very detailed, room by room, cage by cage, I mean, you would think that you were reading about the worst conceivable slum in the most poverty-ridden, disease-ridden city, you know, somewhere around the world. It was not the way it's played up, you know, as pristine labs and so on. It was just horrendous. So that's what this is showing, basically, that these labs are out of control. And I have to say that one of the reasons, there are a number, why the government tries to deal with animal rights people so severely is because in the animal rights movement, there are some very good researchers who have been able to get into these labs, take photos, show what's happening, you know, the government does not want people to find out about this.
Well, I'm beginning to wonder, John, if these diseases and these plagues and all these other things that are out there, these viruses, aren't concocted because of experiments that man is doing and that nature hasn't done anything to us. It just seems like we're doing it to ourselves.
Absolutely. Another thing that really startled me and still startles me when I think about it that I came across back in the mid-80s were experiments that were done on cancer at the National Cancer Institute, which is, you know, a giant federal facility in Maryland. The basic premise was that they wanted to give these animals cancer so that they could find out, hopefully, how to cure it. Well, in order to do that, they had to inject all kinds of chemicals into these animals to suppress their immune systems and make them sick, and then hopefully the cancers would take hold. And then began this truly grotesque period of time in which they were injecting all kinds of viruses and bacteria from other species of animals into other species of animals to the point where nobody could possibly keep track of what was in these animals' bodies. And who knows what kinds of germs emerged from those experiments. I mean, there would be no way to know, absolutely no way to know. And this went on for a period of years at the National Cancer Institute. So you're absolutely right. Once they get rolling in these labs, which are contaminated with germs all over the place to begin with, no matter what they say, and right. I have seen evidence of this, you know, they are percolating facilities for the recombining of germs beyond anybody's ability to figure out what's happening.
The FBI apparently has taken this one very seriously because they've got their FBI Joint Terror Task Force involved. They have polygraphed people. They've had extensive interviews with employees. One employee of the lab, John, has been fired. I mean, so they're taking this seriously, albeit late, but they're trying to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, 2 weeks late or something like that. I'm sure that some of these FBI field agents are, you know, absolutely dumbfounded when they see what's really going on there, because I'm sure that most of these FBI guys out in the field have never been on, you know, cases like this before to any great extent. And when they actually get down to the details of how these animals are kept and what's done to them, I'm sure that their eyes are opened.
How'd you like to be the agent that had to go into the lab to do the interviews?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's no fun at all. And then, you know, somebody in the lab says, well, if you really want to get down to brass tacks, you're going to have to go into the cages. You're going to have to find out. You're going to have to start counting. You're going to have to start raising up and moving the bedding and, you know, the waste, the animal waste in these cages, if you really want to see whether there are any mice left that we haven't found. So, you know, here's your spacesuit because this is a level, I don't know, 3 lab or whatever. I mean, it's a high security containment facility, and so you would have to be protected with all kinds of gear to even go in there in the first place.
John, I was going to say that this is a wake-up call, but it's not, because these kinds of things have happened before at some of these laboratories, and it doesn't seem like anyone is learning anything from this.
I don't think they are. I really don't think so. And I think that at ground level, of course, all the employees and the execs in these labs are covering themselves because they want to keep their jobs. So they will falsify documents and make reports that sound good and do whatever they have to in order to maintain their facility and then get additional funding. So that legislates against the idea of anybody seriously trying to do an investigation. I mean, can you imagine if suddenly Bush came out and said, we have to do a complete investigation of all disease research labs in the United States? I mean, people would be suddenly screaming.
Panicking, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I've got to tell you, this is again, another one of those situations where you just shake your head. Now, it's important for you, and it's important for me to talk about this because it's a major story. But I hate leaving people at home just shaking their head saying, okay, so what do we do about it? What can people do about things like this?
Well, I would say that, you know, pressure can be brought on, say, governors of states. It works, I would say, better at a more local level, like on a state level. Governors, state legislators that are elected, citizens who find out, okay, we've got one of these disease research labs right around the corner, or we've got 15 of them in our state, or whatever it is, they begin to bring pressure. They begin to go to the governor's office. They begin to go to the press demanding, you know, evidence that these labs are safe. And if enough pressure is put on, then sometimes, you know, something can happen. They'll discover more labs like this. And that's what has to be done. In other words, not one lab, but say in the space of 6 months, the press gets a hold of stories about maybe 30 or 40 labs. Now, there's going to be the kind of pressure that could blow it open, and then you get whistleblowers, and then all bets are off because The whistleblowers are the ones that really tell the story.
I'm going to keep you, John, for phone calls next half hour, okay?
Okay, great.
We'll do that. We'll also talk about the avian flu. Where's the pandemic that the World Health Organization was talking about? Here are the phone numbers. West of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line is 818-501-4721. The wildcard line is 818-501-4109. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And now the After Dark newsletter, that's available to you when you call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And one of the little caveats here, when you subscribe or renew, you're going to get a free CD. It's called Perfect Possession. It's an interview that Art did a long time ago with Father Malachi Martin. Perfect Possession. Guess what that's all about? It's kind of scary. 1-888-727-5505 online. CoastToCoastAM.com. Hey, John, before we go to the many phone calls for you, avian flu, World Health Organization said about a year ago this could be a pandemic. They're talking about 40 or 50 cases worldwide. What's going on with this?
Nothing new, really, except that they're really trying to pump this up. In fact, talking about mice, there's yet another lab that has been injecting some version of avian flu. And they're now talking about the possibility that this can skip from mice into humans. And then in the next sentence, they admit that it's a less virulent strain, in their words, than actual avian flu. And as soon as you go to another strain, all bets are off. The experiment is really useless. So it's all propaganda and PR that is aimed at, scaring people to death and bringing in new vaccines for money and drugs for money and exerting medical control over the population under the guise of, oh, everything's going to kill us and we have to obey all these dictates that are handed down. So,
well, you know, it's true, John, that last year when we had a shortage of the vaccine for the flu, that we had less people then who had the doses, and that we had less flu than we had years before that when we had full doses, right?
Exactly. And this story lasted about 10 seconds. You know, it appeared briefly for one day, a light flu season, and then it was buried because, you know, egg on their faces. I mean, they were pumping this up and it's going to be terrible and people are going to be dying left and right. And then just the opposite happened.
Let's go to the phone. So we'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air, and where are you?
Good evening, George. This is 007 calling from Lacombe, Louisiana, headed for New Orleans.
Well, my favorite three numbers. Go ahead.
As I understand it from my history, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're an expert there, if bubonic plague went around the world today, it wouldn't be any worse than a flu epidemic. The reason, as I recall, that it killed so many people in northeastern and in northern Europe was that they were eating off of pewter cookware and pewter plates, which contained lead, and their immune systems as a whole population were shot anyway, and anything that came along would just about wipe them out. They couldn't handle it.
Well, there's a lot to what you're saying. Basically, lead and, you know, probably 50 or 100 other factors were contributing to a very bad state of health for many people in parts of Europe during that time. So whether it would have been plague or whether it would have been a flu virus or whether it would have been, you know, some bacteria really doesn't matter in a situation like that because it takes very little to tip the scales. But on the other hand, if you've got really healthy people, then you don't have that kind of thing happening when you encounter germs. So, you know, that's basically correct what you're saying.
Yeah, you said at the beginning, if this bubonic plague got out, it was just going to hurt people that had impaired immune systems and people who were already weak already. I don't even know why they're fooling around with stuff because it's not that big of a deal.
No, it's anyway, not. I mean, you have to assume that there are a lot of people that are doing, as I said, offensive research. In other words, they're really thinking that they're going to develop some kind of a strain that will be a biological weapon, although they use the cover story of saying we're looking for a vaccine.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, this is Joe calling currently from Wichita Falls, Texas.
Hello, Joe.
Good morning. John, I'd like to take just a moment to let you know how much I appreciate that there are people out there like you that are bringing this to attention to a lot more people out there. The more information that we have, the better a chance we have of creating some of these solutions.
Thank you.
In your opinion, I'm really kind of curious how you've described, you know, people trying to cover this up to protect their jobs, to keep the funding coming in. It doesn't seem like there's a very solid checks and balances in this system. And I was wondering if you had any ideas on, you know, what some potential solutions would be without creating that kind of panic to help get this back in balance.
Well, as I said earlier, you know, if there's enough pressure on local governments where these labs are located, then you get a situation where whistleblowers will emerge. Like, for example, this guy David Graham at the FDA and the Vioxx scandal, who came out and said to Congress, basically, the FDA is not reliable when it comes to certifying drugs as being safe, and created a whole firestorm. And it wasn't that the FDA was reformed, but more people became aware that they can't rely on the FDA in that way. Well, in the same way, if you can squeeze it hard enough, you get a couple of people with conscience to come out of these labs and start telling what's really going on there, then, you know, the press gets a hold of it, and then people become aware that they don't want to live in those areas, and, you know, you get a kind of a cascading effect where there's enormous pressure brought on. But it's not easy because, as you say, we're talking about very secretive facilities. And,
you okay
and
there, John? Problem. You don't have a plague or anything, do you?
No, okay. No, I don't. A little hoarseness.
That's going around. Well, you know, I just wanted to say thanks a lot for your time, and good luck with all the other people you'll talk to tonight.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Appreciate that. You okay there, John?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. Hey, you never know. They may have gotten you already.
I'm looking for mice on the floor, right?
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Where are you? And go ahead.
I'm Joe from Omaha.
Okay, Joe, it's all yours.
I was just wondering if the mice did get out of the lab, how long would it take for this to blow up and become a big epidemic?
Well, I don't think that it would become a big epidemic, as I described before, because...
Not these, at least.
Yeah, not these, because you've got, compared with medieval Europe, you've got people whose immune systems are in much better shape. But where you could have a problem, as I said, would be, for example, in nursing homes and places like that, where people are, you know, teetering on the edge all the time. And that's where, you know, you could have a problem. And if that happened, it could happen soon because, you know, all it takes is you get some mice into areas like that and you get contamination and it begins to spread around the nursing home.
John, when we were talking last year about the contaminated flu shots, how many of these kinds of labs are out there? 3,000? Does that make sense?
Well, that's not a bad estimate. I don't know the full number, but I would say it's at least that many. If you added up the biowarfare labs and then added in the disease research labs, I would think that you'd be closer to maybe 10,000 labs. I would think that that number would escalate considerably, and I might even be lowballing it there because, you know, you've got every university is doing some kind of disease research if they're on government funding. And then you've got government labs, you've got military labs, you've got testing facilities where they're... We went into that, actually. We talked about a lab in Canada, I think it was, where, you know, samples. In fact, that was how it was discovered that the flu vaccine had been contaminated, because they were mixing together samples from the hospital where the lab was of people with the flu. And then all of a sudden here you had samples being sent in for testing from outside, and they got mixed up together. Well, how does that happen? I mean, you know, just people screw up is basically how it happened. So it's an enormous situation. I became apprised of that in the 80s when I started studying this, as to how many labs there really were around the world. And incidentally, how much shipping of materials goes on all the time. I'm talking about biological materials, microorganisms, tissue samples, blood, that sort of thing, that are on standard couriers.
Or planes when we're traveling, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Planes when we're traveling, you know, any way that you can pretty much send a letter, they can send biological materials. And I thought that, you know, these were always highly protected in cases and, you know, were only couriered by special people. But that's completely wrong. The traffic is so heavy in this stuff as it travels from lab to lab that, you know, it's absolutely astonishing.
Next up, Wildcard Line, it's your turn. Where are you calling from?
Hi there. My name is Ira, and I'm from Fort Wayne.
Hi, Ira.
How you doing tonight?
All right.
I actually, incidentally, right with what you were just talking about there, my father used to do deliveries of biological materials from one laboratory to another, and I actually do close to the same thing myself. just thought I'd incidentally add that there. But one question I had was, with everything that's going on with everything down south on the U.S., are there any labs that are down in that area that might have been knocked offline, and what might that mean for us?
Oh, yeah, there are several labs down there. I don't have the number, but I think it's somewhere around 10 or 12 in the area that do infectious disease research or bio warfare research. You know, the PR is that they were warned in time, that the facilities were not disturbed. But I have heard other reports that I can't yet confirm that that's not completely true, that there were some problems in at least one lab down there. And these would be so-called high-level labs where the containment facilities are high security. So that story has barely made it into the press, but it's true. And that has not been thoroughly explored, and we may never hear anything more about it again, unless somebody down there actually looks into it.
We're still getting a microbiologist or two every once in a while, John, dying under strange circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. The list, you know, goes on and on and on. I think that there are several possible reasons for this, and one would be, on the surface, would be that certain biologists become aware that supposed defensive bioweapon projects are actually offensive, that there are scenarios, you know, that are on the board, so to speak, for launching bioattacks. That would be one reason. Another reason, I believe, would be when some of these biologists begin to realize that some of the germs that they've been led to believe that are so deadly are actually not deadly. And as we've described, it all depends on your immune system. And in that case, the entire industry is threatened, because their claim to fame is really that they're dealing with these, you know, highly destructive germs that can kill people by the millions all over the place. And if that turns out to be a lie, which it basically is, then, you know, why all the money that's pouring into these labs for research? So those are just two of the possible reasons that, you know, this could be happening. And another one has to do with the sale of biological materials, which I think may be a part of this as well, because stories, you know, I've written stories on this. I've seen other stories well documented that in the 80s, a number of companies in the United States sent biowarfare materials, including anthrax and botulism and so forth, to Saddam Hussein.
Right.
So, you know, suppose something like that kind of traffic is going on now and somebody uncovers it. I'm not just saying Iraq. I'm saying other nations that would obviously want to have these materials, perhaps to use against us. That would not be out of the question at all, because some of these corporations, you know, only look at the bottom line and they don't care about anything else.
Let's go to one or two more callers, John. That'll wrap it up for us. West of the Rockies, welcome to the show.
Good evening, George.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. It's Scott from Sacramento, California.
Sure, Scott. Go ahead, sir.
And if I remember right, I thought that the squirrels and the Sierras actually had the bubonic plague already.
No, that, I don't know, John.
That who had the bubonic plague?
The squirrels in the Rocky Mountains.
Oh, yeah, they have discovered certain animals that have the plague. That's right. And there's Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and there are other diseases that they have seen in animals, which to me, you know, probably comes down on the side of saying that in normal environments where people are basically healthy, this does not normally constitute a problem. But then you can discover, you know, perhaps if you trace it back, that some of these animals caught these germs from other animals that escaped from labs, because that is always a possibility. You have Rocky Mountain flats out there, for example, and who knows in that storage facility what's really there. I mean, that has been a repository for all kinds of chemical weapons and who knows what else for decades. So that is indeed possible. These labs, you know, are just not what they're cracked up to be. I don't care what anybody says. I've seen enough evidence that no matter how much containment procedure you put in there, especially when you're dealing with animals, that you cannot control the safety of these places.
What's going on with the West Nile virus? What's going on with SARS, John?
Well, these are two major hoaxes that have been pretty much dormant since, you know, we have heard all the PR and the stories. Although they are reporting some new West Nile cases in Southern California, but you know the hype is so thick that it's really impossible to know what they're really saying. Usually, what they mean when they say this is people have developed immune defenses against these germs and have successfully dealt with them. And then when they test the people and they find that out, they misinterpret the results to mean that the people are really in danger of getting sick. It's a complete reversal that's taken place in biological medical research in the last 20 years, and so it's totally unreliable. But, I mean, SARS is, you know, although they try to hype it up now and then, it's a totally dead issue.
Well, your website, nomorefakenews.com, it's a great place for people to go to when they want to get more information on some of these very unusual things that seem to happen all around this country. Anything else on that website you want to quickly tell us about?
Well, I've been covering bits and pieces of the story in New Orleans, and I found it very interesting that the former director of FEMA, Joe Albaugh, was down there recently, self-admittedly pumping up clients because he is now a lobbyist for gigantic firms that wanted, you know, rebuild the entire city. So yet one more example of revolving door in government, where the former head of the agency that's responsible for disaster relief is now down there as a corporate shill trying to get contracts for companies that he represents.
Incredible. Yeah, John, thanks. I appreciate you being on the show, my friend. John Rappaport updating us on that situation where plague-infected mice are missing from a New Jersey laboratory. In a moment, we're going live to the United Kingdom. We're going to talk about Jack the Ripper.